From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, one of America's most controversial newspaper columnists, Maureen Dowd. Her fans find her scathingly funny. One of her critics accuses her of substituting rhetorical disdain for rational criticism. She's written a column about Washington for the New York Times op-ed page since 1995. She won a Pulitzer Prize for her columns about the Clinton impeachment. Now she has a new book collecting her columns called Bush World. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews To Tulsa and Back, the new album by J.J. Cale, and Rule It Down by Canadian-American Ray Bonneville. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer. Two leaders of a mosque in Albany, New York, have been arrested in a federal sting operation related to an alleged scheme to buy a shoulder-fired missile. Investigators say the suspects may have links to Al-Qaeda. Their families say they're innocent. New York Governor George Pataki says the arrests are part of an aggressive effort to ferret out possible terrorists.
And I guarantee you, we will continue to take this effort to defend our freedom and to get rid of those who are among us who want to engage in further attacks. We take this very seriously.
Pataki says the two suspects were allegedly involved in money laundering aspects of the plot. In another sting operation, a joint terrorism task force arrested a Chicago man today on charges he was plotting to blow up a federal building there. NPR's David Shaper reports from Chicago.
Federal prosecutors charged 66-year-old Gail Nettles of Chicago with plotting to use a fertilizer truck bomb to blow up the Dirksen Federal Court Building downtown Chicago. FBI spokesman Ross Rice says the people Nettles allegedly tried to purchase the bomb's ingredients from were actually undercover agents. And Rice says Nettles never actually got explosive materials.
He was arrested today after he had been given an inert version of the fertilizer that he had wanted, ammonium nitrate. That's the largest component that would be necessary to construct the device that he was hoping to make.
Rice says Nettles appears to have been working alone and not part of any larger terror plot. He says Nettles apparently was trying to carry out a personal vendetta against the federal court system, stemming from an earlier conviction on counterfeiting charges. David Shaper, NPR News, Chicago.
There's been heavy fighting throughout the day in the Iraqi city of Najaf. Iraqi forces backed by the U.S. military have been battling forces loyal to Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. The Pentagon says two U.S. troops were killed and 10 were wounded in the fighting. According to NPR's Ivan Watson in Baghdad, the U.S. military says Sadr's militia started the clashes.
Both sides blame the other side for breaking the ceasefire. A U.S. military statement says the forces of Muqtada al-Sadr attacked a Najaf Iraqi police station today before dawn, and that triggered the fighting throughout the day. The governor of Najaf, who's also supported by the U.S. military, he has also denounced Sadr's forces for attacking. However, a Sadr spokesman says that, in fact, it was the U.S. Marines and the U.S.-backed Iraqi police and National Guards who triggered the fighting today.
NPR's Ivan Watson. There were a series of explosions in central Baghdad today. A plume of smoke rose close to the Sheraton and Palestine hotels. On Wall Street today, the Dow lost 163 points to close at 9,963 in active trading. This is NPR. A former Enron trading executive pleaded guilty today to charges he manipulated energy markets during the California energy crisis. 42-year-old John Forney is the third Enron official to plead guilty to manipulating electricity prices. Forney faces a maximum sentence of 5 years in prison. Massachusetts health officials have published new guidelines to improve the quality of obesity surgery and prevent needless deaths. NPR's Richard Knox reports.
11 million Americans are severely obese. This year, 140,000 of them will have surgery to shrink their stomachs. The operation can produce dramatic results, but there are dangers. The Massachusetts Department of Public Health convened an expert task force on obesity surgery this year after several patients died. Officials say the panel's new recommendations are the first of their kind. The panel says patients should seek out hospitals that do at least 100 obesity operations a year. Surgeons should be monitored closely on their first 25 cases. Patients should be selected carefully and supported by multidisciplinary teams. The state's health commissioner says she hopes patients will pressure hospitals to follow the guidelines. She's had weight loss surgery herself. Richard Knox, NPR News, Boston.
The Federal Trade Commission said today that one in six adult Americans was a victim of consumer fraud over the course of a year. The reported fraud ranged from long-distance phone service being switched without the consumer's permission to magazine subscriptions that never arrived. The FTC also said credit card fraud was common, with consumers being urged to pay for credit card insurance they don't need. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, dedicated to advancing entrepreneurship across America, on the web at kauffman.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Maureen Dowd, is one of the most controversial newspaper political columnists in the country. To her fans, her columns are scathingly funny, but not to her critics. In the National Review, she was criticized for taking gratuitous swipes at President Bush and for substituting rhetorical disdain for rational criticism. She has a new book, a collection of her columns from the New York Times, called Bush World. Here's an example of what makes Dowd so controversial. In her column, Adventures in an Alternate Reality, dated April 25, 2004, she wrote, quote, "In Bush World, they struggled to keep church and state separate in Iraq, even as they increasingly merge the two in America. In Bush World, we're making progress in the war on terror by fighting a war that creates terrorists," unquote. Dowd became a columnist for the New York Times in 1995 after reporting on the White House during the Reagan, Bush, and Clinton administrations. She won a Pulitzer Prize for her columns on the Clinton impeachment. Dowd told me she doesn't see herself as representing the liberal or the conservative point of view. She says the media have constructed the red state, blue state divide, and she doesn't want to play into that.
Well, I think, you know, that's sort of why I stopped doing TV, too. When I used to do TV at the beginning of my career, and then producers would start calling and saying, well, tell me which side you're on. And I would say, well, you know, I'm not on one side. They would say, because we want to match you up with someone on the opposite side. And I would say, well, I'm not really on one side or the other. I have thoughts on both sides. And they'd say, well, then we can't use you. And I didn't want to go on either because it just seemed sort of antithetical to creativity and original thinking and critical thinking to just always be defending one side or the other, even if it was against logic or against, you know, what seemed right.
Give me an example of a view that you have on each side, so to speak, you know, something that would be considered too contradictory for the type of show that you're talking about to deal with.
Well, for instance, with Clinton, people often, I sometimes see references to me being hard on Clinton during impeachment. And I guess I was hard in the sense of tweaking him, but I was defending him. And I tried to point out in my columns that the idea of you know, impeaching a politician for having a girlfriend in Washington was completely risible. I mean, my brothers were pages on Capitol Hill at the time when Prescott Bush, this president's grandfather, was a senator, and JFK and Nixon were senators, and Lyndon Johnson. And none of these people were involved in their stories, but my brothers were full of stories about senators, you know, would get drunk and they get their foot caught in the brass spittoons on the Senate floor, and my brothers would have to help them off the floor, or their wives would be calling the cloakroom saying, if you don't get my husband to the phone, I know he's with that woman, I'm going to come down there and, you know, come onto the floor, and my brother would have to race around with the sergeant of arms and look in the Capitol hideaway. So as long as I have, as a Washington native, I've always thought, you know, politics and sex is inextricably intertwined. So in a way, in my backhanded way, I was trying to defend Clinton and say this is absurd, that Ken Starr's report was grounds for divorce, perhaps, but not impeachment. So that's one example, I think, is it?
No, right. And you, so you feel like you were critical of Clinton, but you were even more critical of the people trying to impeach him.
Yes. I mean, to me, one column, I hardly ever get ideas that I love, you know, and it's hard because there's such a tower of Babel now in blogs and cable, you can barely think of an idea before someone else might get the same idea. I have to Google everything now because in the couple of hours before my column goes in, somebody might have said that and it will look like I'm repeating it or it'll be old. And, you know, there's just so much opinion out there now in the ether that, you know, it's just hard to say anything fresh and original. But one idea that I really liked was when I did a column about, without naming names, talking about he was obsessed with sex and he couldn't, you know, he couldn't wait to hear about Monica and it was this and this. And then at the end, it turned out to be Ken Starr rather than Clinton. Maybe you had to read it.
No. But say you wanted to Google. To see if anybody else had said it first. I mean,
nobody did that because that was sort of a specific idea. That they couldn't do that idea. I was talking more about like if you used a line, for instance, about Bush or the Bush people crying Wolfowitz. By the time you might get that in a column. The other day during the convention, I was thinking that Carrie in the infamous spacesuit picture looked like Woody Allen when he played the sperm and Everything You Wanted to Know About Sex. But before I could even write that in a column, Tucker Carlson said it on Crossfire, and then John Tierney wrote it in his New York Times column. So it's just, I just mean it's hard to have originality with so many opinions coming at you all the time.
Do you feel like your column is any more or less valuable now that punditry seems to have taken over the world of politics?
Well, I think, you know, it's funny because I drove down to Leesburg once to have lunch with Russell Baker, and he told me he spent 8 hours a week on his column, 4 hours on each column. And I was trying to figure out what I do, and I am thinking about my column all the time and agonizing about it mainly. And I would say it's not as, for me, I do try and report, but the work is more psychologically draining because you're trying to think of something original.
You know, you've described yourself as not fitting into the red box or blue box categories and wanting to just, you know, have an independent opinion. On the other hand, you're a favorite target of criticism for a lot of conservative pundits. And I wonder if you follow that, if you Google yourself and read people what people are saying about you, and if any of that ever affects what you write.
Well, it's funny. A couple years ago, or it must be more than a couple, maybe three or four, when I first heard of Googling, and there was this young guy in my office, James Bennett, who is our brilliant, brilliant Jerusalem correspondent, and he said, let me teach you how to use Google. And so we sat down at his machine, and he said, I'll punch in your name. And I was saying, I immediately kind of thought, uh-oh. So I said, no, don't do that. But he had already done it. So this thing came up on the screen, which I can't describe on a radio station. Let me say it was my publicity picture with a picture of Clinton, and I was in an obscene act. And James turned completely red, and I turned completely red, and I didn't go on Google for another, you know. And I called the New York Times lawyer, who was this fantastic woman, and I said, is there, you know, this is so embarrassing. If you put in my name, this act comes up. And she said, there's nothing. If we try to do something, it'll just create more attention. So I don't know. You know, now I Google all the time. I just don't put my name in.
Okay, so you don't Google yourself. In case you haven't noticed, there's one blog that has a Dowd watch on it.
You know, I don't read anything about myself because, and this is what, you know, makes me very empathetic with people that I write about. Since I was little, I am so super sensitive. There was this movie called, I always get the name mixed up. I think it was Penny Serenade, I think it was, with Irene Dunne and Cary Grant.
Yeah, that's Penny Serenade, right.
And they adopt this little girl. And when I was little and I watched it, she really dies because she falls off this wire at a Christmas play. But it happens after her parents are ignoring her And then they feel very guilty about it. And I thought she died just of oversensitivity because her parents were ignoring her. And I thought that might happen to me. I was so super sensitive. So my family is just stunned that I get into this business where I'm, you know, kind of ripped apart every day. But I don't read anything. If there's an article or anything, I ask my sister to look at it to make sure I'm not going to be fired in some way. But other than that, I try not to read it.
A little paradoxical, don't you think, that your column really kind of eviscerates some people, either with humor or with, you know, reporting, depending on what kind of column it is. And I mean, you can be very tough on the people you're writing about. And at the same time, you're so sensitive about criticism yourself. Do you ever feel?
Well, I don't tell people not to criticize me. I just don't want to read it. Uh-huh. I mean, you know, I don't.
But you're not uncomfortable criticizing other people since you're so vulnerable to criticism
yes,
yourself?
Yes, no. I mean, it took me a long time to get used to having a column. I'm not a natural polemicist, and it was really hard for me. And 6 months into it, I went to Hal Raines, who was the editorial pitch editor then, and I said, I really don't think I'm temperamentally suited to this. Maybe it's because I'm a woman. Maybe I don't like to mix it up this much. I don't want to hear people attacking me all the time, and I don't want to attack people. I said, I feel like I'm in a Godfather movie. I take one of theirs, they take two of mine. You know, before you know it, there's blood all over the fruit stand. And Hal was sort of like the, you know, the Tom Wolfe, Chuck Yeager type. He had a very calm Southern demeanor, very deep voice. And he nodded and listened as I poured my heart out, and he goes, that's fine. I think I can arrange a transfer back to Metro. Now, it had taken me like 15 or 20 years to get off of Metro. I spent 5 years in a Washington suburb writing Bob Woodward letters, begging him to hire me every day. So the word Metro was like the guillotine focusing my mind. I just said, well, Hal, maybe I could try it for another 6 months. So it's, you know, I don't find it easy either, but I justify it to myself by, you know, it sounds corny, but I think journalists are part of the system of checks and balances. And I think people who are in the White House tend to get in a soundproof booth. And so I think we can help sort of tweak them a little and say, wait a minute, you know, didn't you say you weren't going to nation build, or what's this about?
My guest is New York Times op-ed columnist Maureen Dowd. She has a new book collecting her columns called Bush World. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. New York Times columnist Maureen Dowd is my guest, and she has a new collection of her columns called Bush World, Enter at Your Own Risk. Were you as opinionated when you were a reporter as you are now as a columnist?
No, I'm still not opinionated. You know, if I go to the movies with a girlfriend and I say, wow, I like that, and they say, oh, my God, that was just a piece of junk, then I'll think, oh, yeah, that was a piece of junk. And I always want what the other person orders after I've ordered something. I don't think I'm opinionated in that way. I mean, I've trained myself to kind of be a devil's advocate with politicians who are, you know, who are doing things that, who are using Orwellian speak or doing things that they said they wouldn't do in their campaign. But I'm not naturally opinionated the way Anna Quinlan and Tom Friedman and Bill Sapphire are. I mean, my whole journalism that I loved was letting people reveal themselves through their own quotes in a very leisurely way and, you know, using observation and all the stuff that I really can't use in a column. So it was hard to adjust to that.
Do you think anybody?
In fact, Tom and Anna used to say, you know, when I first got it, they said, you know, don't waste space quoting people. Just use that space to get your opinion across. And I was like, what opinion?
But your columns are so opinionated. I mean, they're satirical. They have strong points of view. I'm having trouble reconciling what you're saying.
Well, I think that's probably why I don't.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's probably why I don't like to go on TV. Or, well, actually, I like radio more than TV. I find it. a better medium for me. But one of the reasons I don't like to do it is because I don't have instant analysis. I really have to sit down and report and think about it and figure out what I want to say. I'm not an instant pundit. Sapphire jokes that I should be on some drug called Punzac, which would make it easier, make you more relaxed to be a pundit. But I haven't quite gotten my doctor to prescribe it yet.
Now, before you were writing a column when you were a Washington reporter, you covered George H.W. Bush's presidency. And you write in one of your columns, though 41 was always gracious, I know he was disappointed at first to have drawn an irreverent, newfangled, quote, reporterette, as Rush Limbaugh would say, who wanted to focus as much on the personalities of leaders as on their policies. He often kidded me about our love-hate relationship, dubbing me his favorite, unfavorite Bigfoot columnist. You say that he was uncomfortable with somebody who wanted to focus as much on personalities as on their policies. Do you see yourself that way, as being more interested, or at least equally interested, in the personalities of politicians as on their policies?
Yes. I mean, I've gotten criticized for that over the years with people saying, you know, I should be more focused on policy in the old days. I don't know, maybe not lately. But I always thought that, for one thing, the vote for president is a very personal vote. I think even before we got into these inane you know, pop quizzes like who do you want to choose the toppings on your pizza or who do you want to watch your kids if you're on vacation, I thought that it was more of a gut reaction. So it makes sense to focus. And even James Reston used to say once we got nuclear capability, you had to know everything about the person who was running the world, because you had to know how they got along with their wife and, you know, what they had for breakfast, because that's how you needed to be able to trust their judgment. And you could only assess that by getting to know a little bit about them as a person. Would they overcompensate? Were they secure? You know, did they have good instincts about who to have around them? Would they have people around them who would, you know, tell them the truth, give them a hard time? And, you know, so it just seems when I've covered politicians, they can say things like Bush Sr. said, read my lips, no new taxes. And Bush Jr. said, you know, he would have a humble foreign policy and no nation building. And then because of either their own gremlins or they're surrounded with certain kind of Iago counselors or different things can happen, and they do the opposite of what they promise. So to the extent you can get a sense of the person rather than simply what policy they're saying they will put into effect, I think it's good.
Do you think that as a reporter, back when you were reporting, that you asked different kinds of questions than other reporters did?
Well, I never asked any questions. The first President Bush was, I remember my bosses at the first nighttime press conference, the first President Bush had, the Washington Bureau, Hal Raines and Phil Taubman gave me a four-part arms control question to ask. And I kept reading it and memorizing it and trying to get up in prime time and say it. And I got over there and I just realized, you know, I would get lost in the thicket of arms control if I tried to do that. So I didn't ask it. And they were very disappointed in me. And as each press conference went on, I never asked a question. And finally, Marlon Fitzwater came to me and said, the president says he's going to ask you a question at the next press conference.
Did he?
No, he never did. He would always tell me to stop staring at him because I wouldn't be, it made him nervous to have someone looking at him who wasn't asking a question.
Did you know George W. Bush when you were covering his father?
I only heard about him very sparingly. He was not in his father's inner circle of advisors. He was sort of lurking around the edge of the campaigns. He was the loyalty enforcer. He was the outreach guy to evangelicals. He hung out with Lee Atwater in the political chop shop. And the only time I really heard of him being involved in policy was when he was brought in to tell Sununu. They'd already told John Sununu, the chief of staff, who was sort of a bull in a china shop, that he was fired, but he refused to leave his office. So they made W go down and say, you know, get out of the office. But the only time I really ran into him was at Kennebunkport once when his father was golfing and I was in the pool. And his father used to love to get the reporters up at 6 a.m. in Kennebunkport, and we'd race down to the golf course and go out and sort of watch him as though we were at the U.S. Open. You know, we'd watch him tee off and everything. And so the father had a great sense of humor. And it was after the campaign he'd won office. And I had in my suitcase a Bob Dole Tough Enough Tour 88 T-shirt and a Jesse Jackson 88 hat. And so I thought it would be funny as revenge for him getting us up at dawn to wear my Jesse Jackson and Bob Dole stuff. Except when he and W came in their golf cart, he wasn't looking my way, but W was. So W gave me this really scary glare and then sent word back to me afterwards that I would pay for that. But I looked, you know, I wasn't worried about it because at that point, Jeb was the heir apparent. And in my computer, you know, I had all this stuff about Jeb. And under W, all I had was George W., Midland businessman. So none of us were trying to talk to him or gather information on him because he was the black sheep.
So did you pay for that?
No. And the day he announced, I interviewed him on the Kennebunkport porch. And he reminded me of it and just was laughing, you know, about his former kind of, he was much more tarred and sort of quick-tempered then, and he became very disciplined and charming when he was running for governor and president.
Maureen Dowd is an op-ed columnist for the New York Times. Her new book collecting her columns is called Bush World. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com, and from audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with the New York Times op-ed columnist Maureen Dowd, and Ken Tucker reviews new CDs by J.J. Cale and Ray Bonneville. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Maureen Dowd. She's written a political op-ed column for the New York Times since 1995. She won a Pulitzer Prize for her columns on the Clinton impeachment. Before becoming a columnist, she reported on the Reagan, Bush, and Clinton White Houses. She's just published a collection of her columns called Bush World. Our interview was recorded yesterday. It's interesting to read columns from the past, in part because you stumble on things like this. And in a June 1999 column during the presidential campaign, George W. Bush, who was then a candidate, told you, "I know what I believe in. I believe the big issues are going to be China and Russia. It's important for the president to think globally, but in the long run, security in the world is going to be how we deal with Russia and how we deal with China." What did you think about when you read that back and preparing your book?
That's an amazing. I think that interview is really amazing. And there's something he goes on a bit in a way. He has one line in there where he says, if, no one is going to fool me or the United States or something, which is so weird because, you know, we have been fooled by Ahmed Shalabi. And so his whole point in that interview, my question to him, and that was the interview on the back porch in Kennebunkport when he first announced. And I said, my main question to you is, doesn't it scare you to run for president without any foreign policy experience? Because because he was overawed by his father, he kind of stayed away from foreign policy stuff because he didn't want to, you know, be sitting at his knee and he didn't want to compete. So he was starting as tabula rasa. And he was very good in a way because he wasn't insecure about it, but he also didn't seem aware of how dangerous that could be. I remember him saying, I'll just ask my advisors. I'll ask Cheney or Condi or Paul Wolfowitz. But I came back afterwards and I was telling Tom Friedman about it, and Tom Friedman said, but what he doesn't seem to understand is the moment will come where two advisors that he really trusts will have a complete difference of opinion. And if he doesn't know anything about the world, how will he settle it? And that moment came, you know, with Cheney and Rumsfeld on one side and Colin Powell on the other. And at that point, he was, the fact that he was so uninformed about the world, I think, came into play.
In one of your columns, you call the Department of Homeland Security the Department of Political Security. Do you think there are political elements either behind the latest alert or behind how the latest alert is being discussed or described?
Well, I think this is the big problem with how they went to war in Iraq by hyping up the WMDs. I mean, it is the president who cried Wolfowitz. I mean, our credibility around the world and Americans' ability to believe the White House has just been severely damaged. How do we know anymore whether what the president and his aides are saying is true or whether, once again, they just have an agenda we don't know about and they're telling us what they want us to think? I think that bond of trust has been shattered. It's very, no one knows. I thought you might ask that, so I went and asked all of our political and national security reporters whether they believed it or not. One of them said, yes, absolutely. You know, we're in danger. One of them said, oh, this whole thing is ridiculous. They finally figured out that New York buildings, you know, are under attack. So they figured out the 9/11 plan 3 years later. Thanks a lot. You know, the front page of the Washington Post today says the president was just crying wolf and it's, you know, it's a severe problem for his credibility. So even the experts don't know, you know, exactly what's going on. And I think it's impossible for us to tell because the president has placed his political viability in a conflict of interest with our safety. He's always spinning our safety. He tried to suppress the 9/11 commission. He wouldn't send Condoleezza Rice to testify until the pressure was on. He refused to give certain documents. He didn't really want to put this stuff that they recommended into play until the political pressure was on. So he keeps trying to keep us from getting the information or doing the things that will make us safer because he's in the middle of a campaign. So I think that's a very frightening and dangerous situation.
Now, we've been talking about some of the criticisms, harsh criticisms that you have of President Bush and his administration. It's not as if you're particularly enthusiastic about Kerry, correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, I don't really think of it in terms of who I like or who I don't like. I just try and either, in the case of Bush, tweak power. In the case of Kerry, I just try and analyze how he's doing. So it's more of a political judgment than a personal judgment. I mean, columnists aren't allowed to endorse anyone anyway, although I'm not sure if Paul Krugman has broken that rule, but we're not supposed to.
And why aren't you supposed to?
Because it's the role of the editorial page to decide
who
the Times will
support.
Although some columnists make it pretty clear, but I don't really want to do that.
About the Democratic Convention, you wrote, the Democratic Convention was focus-grouped, dial-a-metered to death. What was your criticism?
Well, Schramm, you know, had hooked up all these the focus groups to these, they're called, I don't know what the official name is, I called them dial-a-meters, where they test drive every phrase to see how it comes across. You could tell that the line Kerry had about the Saudis was focus grouped. And I think they tamped down Edwards' speech a lot because they were trying to be positive and not negative. And maybe I'm being too naive here, but it just seems to me that sometimes you've got to let rhetoric soar and not focus group it to death. And it the whole convention to me had the feel of something that was very tested and tamped down. And I know, you know, for instance, with Jimmy Carter's speech, he had the line about you can't have a leader who misleads. And I know they wanted to change that to John Kerry will be a good leader or something, you know. So I just feel like a lot of Jimmy Carter resisted, but a lot of the edges were taken off, which was why Al Sharpton, you know, kind of got that incredible response, because people just wanted to hear something from the heart.
About Teresa Heinz Kerry, you wrote, she's unlike any other political wife I've ever seen, unscripted and ready to do as she likes in her intriguing, world-weary way. She has been criticized a lot for being flaky. That's a word that's used a lot, a loose cannon, for telling a reporter to shove it, for saying 4 more years of hell, you know, if Bush is reelected. What's your reaction to that?
I'm having a hard time reacting to her in any way but as a journalist right now. And as a journalist, I love her. I can't get enough of her. She's like this fantastic combination of Isaac Dinesen out of Africa, you know, I had a farm in Africa, and Isadora Duncan kind of dancing around the stage with her scarves to her own music as though no one else on stage matters. And, you know, you so very rarely get, especially wives who are not totally sort of programmed or off to the side, that, you know, it's a fantastic addition to the campaign as far as I'm concerned.
Do you think that that journalists have a double standard in the sense that on the one hand, you know, journalists' dream is to talk to somebody who is unscripted and speaks honestly. On the other hand, if you do that, you're often skewered for it. And I think that that encourages people with public lives to go back to just being very scripted, because it sure is a lot safer.
Well, I think that Mrs. Kerry made the case in her convention speech that the implicit case that the reason she'd been criticized on the shove it comment was because she was an opinionated woman. But I don't think, you know, sometimes women, Hillary Clinton did this with health care. Sometimes women will make a misstep. Like in health care, the package was just too unwieldy. And then they'll say, well, people just couldn't take this from a woman. And I know in society, yes, as my mom would say, women can stand on the top of the Empire State Building and scream, you know, that they're equal, but they won't be until the anatomy is the same. You know, and I understand the inequalities, of course, and as a columnist who speaks her mind, I understand what they're talking about. But I also don't think you can, you know, if you make a misstep, you can't hide behind the idea that it's because you're an opinionated woman. Now, Teresa Kerry, the reporter or columnist who asked her what she had said about using the word un-American, was asking a legitimate question. I mean, he was from a completely scummy, scaife-owned newspaper, and scaife is scummy, and probably treated her badly. But she had made a comment about, you know, un-American and un-Pennsylvanian things seeping into politics. So his question was legitimate. And I think it's fair to question whether, by saying shove it, she kind of took the attention off her husband, who at that moment was trying to fly in, divert his plane, and throw out the first pitch and have this sunny, you know, scene in Fenway Park. So I think it's a legitimate political question about whether she competes for attention too much or takes the attention off. And she knew that the conservatives were going to be gunning for her, trying to make her lose it at the convention. So she sort of played into their hands. So to me, it's not really an issue of whether people accept her as an opinionated woman. I think they like that side of her. The question is she taking the spotlight from him too often?
My guest is New York Times op-ed columnist Maureen Dowd. She has a new book collecting her columns called Bush World. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Maureen Dowd. She writes a political op-ed column for the New York Times and has a new book collecting her columns called Bush World. How much actual reporting do you do now that you're a columnist?
I try to do, I mean, I want my column always to be reported, but unfortunately, when you're a columnist, the pool, Tom Friedman said to me, you can never make another friend once you have a column. So I hope you like the friends you have, and I do. But also the pool of people you can talk to gets smaller and smaller because people don't want to give you interviews. I mean, I prefer, my favorite thing is just, you know, sometimes I do these cultural interviews and go and ask Bush and Kerry what movies they watch and what TV shows they watch. And I love that because when you get them on a different subject and they don't have prepared speech chunks, you can really learn a lot. And it isn't even whether they're cultural. You can learn how they relate. And most of the time, the politicians who come across best don't know much about culture, but they're not insecure about it, and they're very engaging. Like W said, oh, my favorite cultural activity is baseball, and, you know, I love cats. And it was kind of, you know, he came across as very sweet rather than, I mean, Kerry in his interview was being a little pretentious and talking about how he wrote poetry and he'd had an encounter with a deer and that morning and had written his doggerel about it. So it isn't how much you know, but it gives you a window into the person. But if you do a column they don't like, then, you know, your chances of actually getting to hear them talk and see them in person get to be less. And I think that's the hardest thing, because I would much rather get to see them and have their quotes than have my opinion of them, which makes them mad, which makes them not talk to me.
Do you think that politicians often leak to the press for their own means? And do you trust information that's leaked to you?
Well, as I say, you know, I don't really have any sources because no one speaks to me. But, you know, I found early on that you don't really suffer when you don't have sources. And especially I think the whole Iraq war has proven this point, because the people who had the great sources ended up doing bogus stories because the sources were giving bogus information. They fooled both journalists and the President of the United States and the Secretary of State. During Bush 1, John Sununu got mad at me one time. I think he even put some sort of curse on my head. I forget what. But he, something I wrote, and he kicked me out of his weekly briefings. And at first I was devastated. And Hal Raines, who was the Washington bureau chief then, said, don't worry, there will be 10 more people standing in line to talk to the New York Times, to get their name on the front page of the New York Times. And that turned out to be true. But what also turned out to be true was I realized as time went on that he wasn't feeding me his spin and misleading stuff. So my stories were better and truer than the reporters who were getting all the garbage in their stories.
You talked a little earlier about how you're uncomfortable, like, having opinions and giving opinions outside of your column. And you're not very comfortable doing television, you said. I want to quote something that Howard Kurtz wrote in his book review of Ted Koppel's book from a few years ago about Nightline. And you had been a guest on Nightline, and Koppel wrote a paragraph about that. or approximately a paragraph in the book. And so this is a quote from Howard Kurtz's book review. A segment on the style of George Bush's presidency featuring Maureen Dowd of the New York Times and Alessandra Stanley, then of the Time magazine, turned, quote, stupefyingly dull, in Koppel's words, when Koppel stuffily insisted on exploring such matters as U.S. troop levels in Europe. We've sort of run out of things to say, Koppel declared as the show dragged on. We'll catch fire when we come back in a moment, the host promised. Finally, he thanked his guests, saying, we must do this again. Not too soon. Koppel later.
It was.
And it says Koppel later apologized to the women for his rude behavior. Was that like a horrible experience for you?
It was. You know how you have that nightmare where you get on national television, you don't know any of the answers to the test?
Yes.
It was that night. My friends were falling off their beds laughing. Alessandra talked me into this. She said it would be about the style of the first year of the Bush White House, which I felt no one on earth knew more about it than I did. I was the New York Times White House reporter, and even though I didn't like TV, I felt prepared to talk on that subject. But apparently, Ted Koppel was grumpy that he didn't want to do a political show that night, and he, you know, decided to teach us a lesson. And the one thing you don't want is to be taught a lesson on air by Ted Koppel. And I had told the woman, the producer or the booker, that Andy Rosenthal, my partner, was doing the Bush military budget and that I didn't know anything about it and couldn't answer any questions. And she said, I will assure, you know, Mr. Koppel of that. And it was the night of the State of the Union, but I was getting ready for my Bush style program. And so Ted, in order to prove how boring politics was, this is my theory, he might say something different, decided to, like, ask really boring questions. And so he has Alessandra on, who's this fantastic style expert on the Bush White House, and he's asking us these very complicated budget questions. So he turns to me, and we're on national television, and he goes, Maureen, can you tell me the difference between the 1990 and 1991 military budget, and be specific? And I have to say, my whole life flashed before my eyes, and I peeked over at Britt Hume and Jeff Greenfield, thinking they would save me somehow, and they didn't. And the time stretched and stretched on. And I remember saying, thinking I'd do what I'd seen other people do. And I said, well, Ted, I don't think that's the question. I think the question is Bush's personal relationship with leaders and how he drives them on motorboats and tries to forge this personal relationship. And Ted goes, well, that's just silly. And it went downhill from there. And I remember his last words to us were something like, we'll come back, but not too soon. And Alessandra went in Valley Girl talk, thanks a lot. And that's the last line in the transcript. And he wrote me a letter of apology, which is more valuable to me than all the letters I've gotten from presidents, because I think it's probably the only one in existence. But you don't want to be on Nightline the night. They were referring to it in the control room because the booker rushed up to the control room to say, we told her we wouldn't ask about the military budget. You don't want to be on the show that is referred to in ABC as the night Ted lost it. That is not where you want to be.
Did that scare you away from doing TV?
It did, but I have to say also what we talked about before, I just didn't want to be in the conservative liberal box. So it was a good excuse to be scared away from TV. And when I see Ted Koppel now, you know, he's always teasing. He's always going, oh, come back. I'm like, I don't think so.
Does the pressure ever get to you of having to come up with something to say that everybody else isn't saying that's also funny, you know, a couple of times a week?
Yeah, the first couple of years I had the column, I was basically curled up on the floor of my house every night crying. And then I went to the gym and I went to a nutritionist and I've tried to, you know, not have so much pressure. But, you know, one time during the Clinton stuff, Mike McCurry called me at home and screamed into the phone, you are draining us of our precious bodily fluids. And I just had to laugh because I felt that they were draining me, you know, but you know, it's an amazing, I mean, it's the best real estate in journalism. Mostly I realize how incredibly lucky I am. And it's scary sometimes I wake up and think, oh my gosh, you know, people are listening to you. You're giving opinions in the New York Times. But I take it really seriously, and I try to do it as responsibly and well as I can.
Well, Maureen Dowd, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Maureen Dowd is an op-ed columnist for the New York Times. Her new book collecting her columns is called Bush World. Coming up, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews a new CD by J.J. Cale and one by Ray Bonneville, who fits into the tradition Cale established. This is Fresh Air. J.J. Cale is best known for writing early 70s hits for himself and Eric Clapton, such as After Midnight and Cocaine. Cale's vocal and guitar style are characterized by a leisurely and laid-back tone. To Tulsa and Back is Cale's first studio album since 1966. Rock critic Ken Tucker thinks another artist, Canadian-American Ray Bonneville, could be Cale's slightly younger counterpart, and that his new album, Roll It Down, is a worthy complement to the tradition Cale has established.
My gal don't like them red, red roses. She don't like perfume. Now my gal ain't got no fancy notion. She just likes to make love all night and sleep all afternoon.
The question with a performer like J.J. Cale is simple. Why? Why keep making music when you're probably past your prime? Why keep working changes on a style that half the pop music audience knows in its sleep, and the other half wouldn't know if you threatened to put them to sleep? Why, in short, should we listen to J.J. Cale in 2004? Well, because of songs like this.
One step forward and two steps back, then canyon breaks upon my back. Balls man come when you ain't getting paid, till the house is built and the bricks are laid. It's made out of wood, made out of stone. I'm a builder that man in a fancy home. That's the way it is, let me tell you.
For a guy who spent a lot of time talking about the pleasures of not doing much, Cale sounds freshly engaged in To Tulsa and Back. That song, One Step, finds a narrator talking about his regrets at finding himself in the position of having to do a lot of manual labor for an employer he resents. Resentment is a fresh theme in Cale's music, but he's careful not to make it sound like pity. He takes it a step further in The Problem.
Have you heard the news that's gone? The man in charge has got to go, 'cause he dances round the problem, boy, and the problem is the man in charge, you know. Now the young...
J.J. Cale uses the phrase, the man, the way they used to in the late 60s, as a figure of corrupt authority. But he does so in the midst of a shuffling, easygoing rhythm that allows one guitar riff to snake through the song and stiffen like a spine. You can hear Cale's influence on the playing of Ray Bonneville in a song like this, Stand Real Still.
Woman got no sleep last night. A line of storms came through. Baby woke up crying. Took a while to sue. Elbows on. Table's edge, tied to the bone.
song, and I had it just seemed to come along if you stand real still. If you stand real still, if you stand real still, you can hear a heartbeat.
A dual citizen of Canada and the U.S., Bonneville is a bigger deal up north. His new album, Roll It Down, won Canada's Grammy, the Juno Award, in the past year. Bonneville has a lot of Delta blues, New Orleans funk, and a Bob Dylan rasp.
Out of a dream, ever slow, the ringing of a telephone. I just say your name was now, don't I know you somehow.
Both J.J. Cale and Ray Bonneville are best at making romantic yearning and regret deceptive. The music comes across initially as laid back and slowly reveals the fervor of men struggling for emotional control. Like the terse, cut-off characters in hard-boiled fiction, they tip their hands whenever they pluck a guitar string.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed To Tulsa and Back by J.J. Cale and Roll It Down by Ray Bonneville, which will be released here later this month. I'm Terry Gross.
I ain't parading, I'm serenading, and I'll probably miss the ball. But if this ditty is not so pretty, at least it'll tell you how great you are. You're the top, you're the Coliseum.
We're ending with this song to say farewell to our terrific researcher, Jessica Chu. For the last 4 years, Jessica has tracked down background information I've relied on to prepare my interviews, and she's watched our back with her speedy and reliable fact-checking. Jessica has also edited many of our interviews and worked with our colleagues at NPR to maintain the Fresh Air webpage. On top of all that, we couldn't have hoped for a more unfailingly pleasant and professional colleague. Jessica is leaving us to attend Yale University, where she'll pursue a master's degree in public health. We wish her success and hope that she'll find friends at Yale who will appreciate her as much as we do.
You're the top. You're Mahatma Gandhi. You're the top. You're Napoleon Brandy.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Delacorte Press, publisher of Lucifer's Shadow by David Hewson, a novel of intrigue and art spanning three centuries in Venice, new in hardcover, and by Nonesuch Records, featuring Hymns of the 49th Parallel, the new album by Katie Lang, a tribute to Canadian songwriters Neil Young, Joni Mitchell, and five others. It's available at Barnes & Noble Music locations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we remember Gretchen Worden, the longtime director of the Mutter Museum in Philadelphia. She found beauty in the medical oddities and deformities displayed at this medical museum. She died Monday after a brief illness. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.